Right, first I want to give a tremendous yishkoach to Rabbi Grossman, who put together this program. Rabbi Grossman, I've worked with him for many years, and he's just phenomenal, his attention to detail, and he just coordinates everything. It comes across like it's just smooth and easy, but it involves an enormous amount of time and preparation, and he should have the koach to continue producing such outstanding programs. Okay, the reality is, in the world of kashrus, and Rabbi Schoenfeld addressed this briefly, in the world of kashrus, there are good hechsherim and there are bad hechsherim. My purpose here is not to knock the bad hechsherim, but it's just important to know that there are hechsherim that are not good, so that to understand what does it take to give a hechsher of quality. There's really three categories of hechsherim that are inadequate. One is given by people who are kali rosh, people who simply don't care. Baruch Hashem, this is the miyuta de miyuta. It's a small minority of people. But there are people out there, Rabbi Schoenfeld told his stories about the mashgiach whose picture was on the wall. I once visited an animal vegetable plant and I asked the owner of the company, they had applied to the U and they were under at that time another hashkacha. I asked the owner, how often does the mashgiach visit? He says, we never saw the mashgiach. He only communicates with us through the mail. I had a colleague who was a rav in a certain community, and some fellow came in and gave hashkacha to a bakery. He went into the bakery and he saw that they were using trefa cheese. So he called up the rav hamachshir and he says, how can you give hashkacha? They use, versus a chutzpah that you come here without speaking to rabbanim, but they're using trefa cheese. So he says, it's batel b'shishim anyway. I mean, it's such stupidity. He probably doesn't know what shishim is. I mean, there's such incompetence on his part. But Baruch Hashem, that's really just a minor segment of the people out there that are giving hechsherim. Then you have a group of people who lack technical skill, who just simply don't know what they're doing. One of the things that I'm sure has come across in this series is the complexity of giving hechsherim. The food plants today are very complicated. Rabbi Schoenfeld, in his very expert way, presented to you some of the complexities in an oil facility, and that's true across the board. They're complex facilities. And I'll just tell you one story of a person who was actually a very significant Talmud Chacham. I visited a plant with him. He was visiting this facility for 30 years, but he didn't know what was going on in the company. It was, they made bakery mixes, and they had dairy and parv mixes. And before we walked into the plant, I said to him, does the company use heat? Because if it's a heated product, so then the issues that Rabbi Schoenfeld talked about, if it's heated, it has to be kashered. If it's not heated, it doesn't have to be kashered between dairy and parv. So he said, there's no heat in the plant. So we walk into the plant. In 2 seconds, I saw that the dairy product was heated. How did I know it was heated? Because in companies, they don't cook the way your wife cooks in the kitchen. They don't have just little stoves with burners and pots in the fire. They have these huge kettles. It could be 20 feet high. And how do they heat the kettles? The kettles are steam jacketed. That means that they have, has a double wall, and there's a steam pipe leading to the kettle, and the steam injects the heat into the wall of the kettle, and that's what heats the product. So I saw there was a steam line running to the kettle. So I said to the Rav Amasha, I said, you told me it's cold. I said, why is it steam jacketed if it's cold? So he said to me, what's a steam jacket? You know what a steam jacket is. Now that's like if you're learning Shabbos, you don't know what Reisha Yud stands for. I mean, it's such amaratzis. You know, I always said it, if the fellow had tripped and he had bumped into the kettle, he would have seen that it was hot. He would have realized that it was a hot kettle. But he never touched the guy. I took his hand. I said, look, put your hand not in the kettle. He touched it. He says, wow, I never knew that it was heated. So you have to have certain basic knowledge in order to give, and that's like maybe an extreme example, but the fact is, kashrus is very complicated, and you have different levels of expertise of people out there. So that's a second problem in terms of giving hechsherim. But by far, the reason why there are hechsherim that are, I just don't make the grade, I would say the most significant factor is that the people don't know how to give a hechsher in the sense that they are naive, they're not suspicious, they're not vigilant, they're burned out, and that's why they don't need a hechsher. And I always feel that talking about this is perhaps the most important aspect if you're interested in going into the area of kashrus, or if you're going to become Rabbanim in the future, Amir Tashem, and you'll be the Rabbanim are responsible for kashas. I just as an aside, I would say Rabbanim oftentimes go to cities and they feel they don't have the expertise and therefore they don't get involved in kashas. That's a terrible mistake. It's the achrayus of the Rav to be in charge of the kashas. So you may have professional staff, you hire people, but the Rabbanim have to be involved in the kashas. It's their achrayus, it's their responsibility, and they're the ones that have to set the standards in the community. So if you're going to go into kashas, the ideas are important, but it's similar like if you have a derech in learning, so you'll figure out the sugyas. If you know something you don't know, you'll pick up the ideas. But you can have a lot of ideas, but if you don't have a derech, you're lost. And the same thing is true in kashas. If you don't understand the derech, how to be a good mashgiach or a good rav hamashir, then you can have all the ideas in the world, you can have all the technical information and all those things, you can attend the whole series and everything is to know. But if you're like a mashgiach who's a naim lehem v'lo yiru, so what good is it? You have all the ideas, but they're a mashgiach and they walk into plants, they wait for the wild pigs to come charging at them. Ah, I see the chazer. It doesn't work that way. So you have to be able to be a good investigator, and you have to be like a Sherlock Holmes. You have to figure out what's going on. You got to be able to uncover the realities in the plant. Most of the time, mashgiachim are not there on a tmidi basis. And you have to have the ability to walk into the plant and be a snoop and figure out. And you have to do it in a Bekavadik way, because you can't walk in and show them that Rabbi Schoenfeld talked about trust. You can't show them that you don't trust them, because then your relationship is shot and you have to treat people with respect and with derech eretz. Otherwise, you can't have a relation. You need the cooperation of the company. It has to be a cooperative effort. So that has to be based on, you treat them with respect, but it has to be chabdeo v'chashdeo. There has to be an underlying suspicion that maybe you don't know what's really happening. And if there's one lesson that we learned from the Muncie scandal of the meats, is that even people, the person, the butcher in Muncie was a Magid Shir, and is about Tefillah and about Stucker, and everybody thought he was Gevalik, and therefore they weren't watching him carefully. And the lesson is, you can't trust anybody when you have the responsibility for kashas, you can't trust anybody. And that's a problem attitudinally, because, you know, and how in terms of our approach to people, so we're trained to be don l'kaf schlus. I mean, that's what there's a mitzvah to be don l'kaf schlus. But when it comes to kashrus, if you're don l'kaf schlus, you're a lost soul. If I hear a mashgiach using the word, I ask him, how do you know? He says, well, I trust the manager, I trust the owner, I trust this guy. You can't trust people. In halacha, halachically, it's not true. You can't trust people that don't have nemunas, so you can't trust them. And the reality is that people that don't have nemunas are not trustworthy. Rav Moshe has two tshuvos in the Igros Moshe in Yoredeya. The one is in Yoredeya, Chelek Al Simin Lendalad, and the second one is in Chelek Bay Simin Mem Gimel. Rav Moshe talks about whether if you know that somebody is very trustworthy, you've had a long-standing relationship with them, and you feel you could trust the person, is that, even though the person maybe in halacha doesn't have a status of an aid neman, but based on the fact of your relationship, maybe that establishes an anansadi. So Rav Moshe has a very big chiddush. Rav Moshe, the tshuva was written in 1934. He was asked about people in Moscow whose children became communists, and the parents were still shomrei mitzvos, and they wanted to know if they could eat. If they could eat in their children's homes. So Rav Moshe says that there's a concept, he brings rise from different sugyas, there's a concept of kimli. That if a parent has a relationship with a child, he can say kimli, and based on that, he could trust his child. But in the second tshuva, in Yoredeya Chelek Beis Simin Mem Gimel, Rav Moshe elaborates on that, and he says, so let's say you have a friendly relationship with somebody, and you feel the same way that kimli. So Rav Moshe says that you would only say kimli if it's a family relative, it's your a spouse or a parent or a child who you've had a long-standing relationship for years, and you based on that relationship you know that they would not lie to you. But if it's somebody that you just have even if it's a good friend, Rav Moshe says that you would not, the fact that you know that they're an honest, so-called honest person, Rav Moshe says honest people when they're under pressure and there's financial losses and things like that, so people fluff. And unless they have Yerush Shemayim, so that halachically they're neman, so then Rav Moshe says that there's no nemanus. And the truth is that when it comes to kashrus, even if the person has halachic nemanis, you still have to be, the Rav HaMashir, the Mashiach, has to be vigilant. I'm not saying al pidin, of course al pidin, you could trust it, but that, the role, I read this from Rabbi Belsky many times, the role of the Mashiach is not to do everything only at the level that it says in Yoredeya. You have to go, you have to ensure, you have to guarantee, you have, that's the responsibility of the Rav HaMashir, to always probe, to always say to himself, how do I know? How do I make sure? How do I find out what is taking place here? And this is an attitude that is fundamental to giving a hechsher. A person has to be a snoop, and you have to be able to find out what's going on. I remember we once had a company called Shalat that was in Chicago, and they made fancy prepared chickens, and they had a mashgiach tmidi in the plant. And it had it was under the OU, everything was fine and dandy. One day, a disgruntled worker called up and he said, you know, this company is cheating. They're packaging tray for chickens in another location and they're putting on the OU seal. And I spoke to I called the Rav HaMashir who was an exceptionally competent person and he said, it's impossible. I know these people, the people were, close friends of his. I know the people. It's impossible that they should be doing such a thing. But the fact is the attorney general got involved and we did an investigation and it turned out, we investigated through their books, it turned out that in fact that's what was happening. They had two sets of plumbers, one set of plumbers that the Mashkiach had and another set of plumbers, and they were packaging someplace else. It happened to be a violation of federal law. There was major fines, like $500,000 against the management of the company. But here you had the Mashkiach, he almost swore to me, yeah, it's impossible. Nothing is impossible in the world of kashrut. So you have to have that type of vigilant attitude. And I want to share with you a number of stories because a story is the best way of illustrating the point. You know, I could say over and over again, you have to be vigilant, you have to be, but I'll tell you, I want to share with you a number of stories that will give you a certain sense, a feeling of how a mashgiach has to be astute and he has to be able to uncover what is taking place. We have a mashgiach who works for us, Rav Gershon Siegel, who's also a Rav in the Boston area. Very astute fellow. He was supervising a bakery, at that time he was living in Chicago, it was in the Midwest, and the bakery, was making, it was a, they were manufacturing pies. So he walked into the bakery one day, and the pies were round, and then he looks for the pie shells, and he could only find pie shells that were square. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that you can't make a round pie in a square pan. So he went right away to the management, he says, what's going on? And his suspicion was that they were buying, ready-made, pies, some raw pies, and they were baking them off in their facility. He spoke to the managers. The management said, oh, Rabbi, he said, just today we threw away our old pans. We had round pans. We threw them away. You'll come back tomorrow. You'll see that we have new pans. Okay, so he comes back the next day, and indeed they had shiny new pans that were round, and everything looked wonderful. They're making round pies in round pans. But Rabbi Siegel is a snooper. So he took the pie dough of a finished pie, and he turned it upside down, and the pie dough had embedded in it the name of the company that was engraved in the pie shell, in the metal shell was engraved the name of the company that appeared in the dough, and the name that was on the pie dough didn't match the name that was on the shell and on the metal molds that they have. So it was obvious that's not what they were making so that's the type of, that's what I'm talking about, that you have to be, you can't just take things at face value. I once had a company that called me up, a competitor called me, and sometimes you get the best information from a competitor. The company, this goes back maybe 24 years ago, a long time ago, they were making a hot dog type product. And they were using casings, and there's such a thing as an edible casing. If a restaurant wants to keep hot dogs cooked and heated but not dry them out. So they, if it's in an edible casing, so you could keep it heated, and it'll maintain the moisture. The edible casings are, I mean, you could use a plastic casing, but that's not edible. So the edible casings are animal products. And it's like the casing that they used to use for Kishka. So there was a company that was making kosher edible casings at the time. So the competitor called me up and he told me that this particular company is using trefa casings. I called the Mashkiach, I called the Rav Amash and said, it's impossible. We know exactly where the casings are coming from. They're only using the kosher casings. So this competitor had told me the name of the manufacturer of the non-kosher casings that they were buying. So I called up the manufacturer of the non-kosher casings, and I said to the fellow, what I said was not true. I asked Ari Belsky, he said he held up, he didn't, it's okay to do that. I said to the manufacturer, I said, I'm in the kosher food business. We do supervision. And I know that casings is a product that many of our companies would like to use. Perhaps I could help promote your product. And could I share with you the names of some of our clients that are making these products that might be able to benefit from your casings? And he said, sure. So I said, there's this company. He says, no, we don't sell to them. And this company, we don't sell to them. And then I mentioned the name of the company that I was interested in. He says, yeah, sure, we sell to them all the time. So I knew that they had non-kosher casings. So I went to the plant. And I spent 3 hours looking for the non-kosher casings. And if I didn't know that they were there, I wouldn't have done what I did. But I took off of the shelf every single box in the plant. And they had like 3 tiers and all the way in the back. I literally went through every box in the plant and I could not find the non-kosher casings. But I knew that it had to be there. So I went, they had these huge garbage pails that they were using. I said, turn over the garbage pails, because I know that the best information you could get is in the garbage pails. And sure enough, in the bottom of one of the garbage pails, there was empty boxes of non-kosher casings. And it became evident that they were using non-kosher casings. And they had a Mashkiach Tmidi. And I still, to this day, I don't understand how they got it past them. But they were using non-kosher casings in this facility. And I'll tell you another story about snooping around in the garbage. I'm not saying you know that you should spend all your time snooping in the garbage, but I just want to give you a sense of how vigilant and careful you have to be. This is the story of my pizza shop in Edison. Also goes back about 20, 22 years. We had a pizza shop in Edison under our VAD supervision. I used to go into the pizza shop almost daily. The other rabbanim used to go in, and they had only kosher. They had, it was Chol of Yisrael. They had the cooler was full to the top, right up to the ceiling with kosher cheese, olam cheese, everything looked gewaldic. One day I walked into the store and I see that in the store they had cans, these number 10 cans, the large cans without a label. So why is there no label on the can? Probably he's trying to hide something from me. So I said, what's in the can? So he says, it's green beans. Now, I knew it wasn't green beans because engraved on the can it said Spain. And then I don't think they make green beans in Spain. So I said, okay, open the can. So he opened the can and it was plums. So, okay, so first I was upset. You know, he obviously had lied to me. The fact is that canned plums doesn't need hashgacha. I would have allowed him to use it. But he thought that we wouldn't allow it, so therefore he took off the label. So, but what was still troubling me was that usually you don't buy one can at a time. You buy a case. And I couldn't find, I had gone through the store top to bottom. I didn't see the rest of the canned plums. So he had an office across the street. So I said to him, let's go to your office. I want to see what else maybe you have in your office. So he took me across the street to the office. And the office was down a stairwell. Underneath the stairwell, I was walking down the stairs with him, and he takes out his keys and he starts fidgeting to open the door to his office. Under the stairwell were bags of garbage. So you know already that's my favorite place to look. So I started looking around one of the bags of garbage. He sees me looking in the bag of garbage. He grabs one of the bags and he darts up the stairs with the bag of garbage. So he's running away with the bag of garbage. So I got to be in hot pursuit. So I ran after him. Those days I was able to run fast. So I run up the stairs. He's already halfway down the block with the bag of garbage. I run down the block. My tits is flying. I'm holding onto my hat and everything. And my jacket's flying in the wind. Finally, I catch up to the guy. He darted like behind the truck. And he's trying to shtup the bags of garbage underneath the truck. I pulled out the bags of garbage. It's a funny story, but the end of the story is not funny. Because unfortunately, in the bags of garbage, there was empty boxes of non-kosher cheese without any hashgacha. So he says to me, "Oh, Rabbi," he says, "this garbage has been underneath the stairs for 5 years. We never use that product." Okay, so why was he running away with it? But in any event, I looked at the expiration date on the cheese. So let's say it was October 1984, so the expiration date was June 1985. So it was like 7 or 8 months hence from the time that I had found the cheese. So it was obvious that it was not 5-year-old, but cheese doesn't last for 5 years. And so it was obvious that they were using the cheese. And the question was, how did they get the cheese into the store? I mean, we were there all the time, we never saw the cheese. So what eventually, when he was finally moda that he was using trefa cheese, what emerged was that, you know, in a pizza shop, if you walk into a pizza shop and you ask for a slice of pizza, the guy doesn't go take a block of cheese and start grating it in order to make your pizza. And they have no business. So they have tubs, and the tubs are full of grated cheese. So he would come into the store late at night when the store was locked. He would close the shades, and he would bring in his trefa cheese, and he would grade the trefa cheese and have that in the bin, so that when you walked in the daytime, so there were stacks of bins with trefa cheese, but you figured the trefa cheese probably came from the kosher cheese. He was saving at that time, and this goes back over 20 years, he was saving $1,000 a month. He was using 50% kosher and 50% trefa. And he was saving himself $1,000 a month by doing that. And one lesson that I learned is that our VAD would never supervise, and they all use the same thing, we would not supervise a pizza shop where the owner himself is not this fellow happened not to be a Shomer Mitzvah. We would not, or he was a partial Shomer Mitzvah, but we wouldn't supervise a pizza shop where the owner is not a Shomer Mitzvah, because it's not difficult to cheat. It's not difficult to substitute product. When I first came to the OU about 25 years ago, one of the companies that we certified manufactured apple juice for babies. And you would think that a company like that would be a model of integrity. Here they're manufacturing apple juice for babies. But in fact, the management of the company at that time was behind bars. And the reason was because they were bottling apple juice that was really beet juice. They were buying drums of beet juice, and beet juice happens not to need hashgacha. So Mashkir saw the beet juice, but he didn't think anything of it. And they were putting the beet juice into the bottles, and then putting in an apple juice flavor in order to that it should taste like apple juice. And I guess none of the babies complained that it didn't taste right. So, and this was going on for a significant amount of time. So, even though you're dealing with a highly professional company, but you still have to be vigilant. Now, I'm not saying that you can't trust everything the fact that if you're not going to trust the son of Levi, you can't buy anything. You go to the store to buy a bag of sugar. How do you know it's sugar? Maybe it's chaser schmaltz. So, al pi din, you're not mechuyev to test everything and take it to the laboratory. But I'm just showing you that the possibilities that exist for a person to falsify what it says on the label and misrepresent it. And I'll tell you a story. It's a great story. I'm not going to tell you the name of the company, but this is just, again, it just shows you the what you have to watch out for. Here's another story that goes back also about close to 25 years ago. There was a company that they all used certified that was manufacturing a product that was Parv, and this was unique in the industry. Everybody else was making the same product as a dairy product, and they were making it Parv. They had a plant manager who was a chemist, and he developed a special formula to be able to make the product as a Parv item
whereas everybody else was making it dairy.
What they had, what other companies were putting in, they made it dairy, typically was casein. Casein is the protein in that's usually that in milk protein is called casein. So he was substituting a part of casein. He was using pea casein, casein that derived from peas, in the product. The fellow, he happened to be a Jewish fellow. He his daughter got engaged. The day of the wedding, there were people from the OU that were going to the wedding, and the guy died. He died right before his daughter got married. After he died, about 3 months later, the company notified us that the government had been investigating what's going on in the plant, and it was discovered through different workers who had informed the government inspectors that this was the following scheme was taking place in this plant. This company was buying, where did they get their pea casein from? There was a certified company that had a reliable hashgacha that was selling pea casein. The company was buying pea casein from this company. The reality was, what was really happening was that the company, this fellow was and they called him the magician because he was able to develop products that nobody else was able to make, but you'll see why in a second. So he went ahead, he ordered regular milk casein for the company. He would order them in these huge 100-pound bags, and they would be delivered to the company, and then he would have the casein shipped off-site to another location. And he would have workers who didn't speak the English language at that location, and he would take the casein, the milk casein, out of those bags and repack them into other bags that had the name on those bags of this company that had a hashgacha for pea casein. That company was really his own company, and he found somebody to represent, to approach the kashrus agency for him, and he had some kind of dummy plant that really was doing very minimal work, but they needed to have that name approved with the kosher symbol. So he was packing the dairy casein in bags that said pea casein. Then the bags would be shipped back to the plant, and they would arrive with the label that said pea casein, and the company would pay, I think it was like $200 for each sack of the pea casein that would arrive at that facility. So over the course of 2 years, he stole approximately $4 million from the company. He was selling them their own product. That was the gainus here. It was a Yiddish cup. He bought milk casein, repacked it under a different name, sent it back to the company, charged them for it, sold it to them, and misrepresented it as part of casein. And not only was he deceptive with respect to the company, he was deceptive in terms of the kashrus as well, obviously. Maybe the evidence of the product was butl, I don't know. But again, I'm not saying that al pidin, you're mechuyev to take everything to a lab, but you just have to be aware of how vigilant you have to be. Now, I was involved once with a certain bakery, and the bakery was all parv. It was not a dairy parv bakery. It was an all parv bakery. And let me just tell you as an aside, I've been in a lot of dairy parv bakeries, and many of them are churbanos. They're very, very difficult. I'm not saying you can't have a reliable dairy parv bakery, but you got to have terrific people, and it's got to be controlled very well. Anyway, so there was this bakery that was all parv. Everything was parv in the store, and it was carefully checked. The store was sold afterwards to new owners. When it was sold, the chief baker approached the owner of the new owner, and he said, "Do you want us to continue using the milk powder?" She said, What milk powder?" He says, We would use milk powder." He says, "I didn't see any milk powder." He says, "Well, every night at 1 o'clock at night, we would go across the street to the supermarket and buy milk powder. And then we would have the empty soy flour bags, and we would pour the milk powder into the soy flour bag. And that's how we used the milk powder." What I learned from that is that in the bakeries that we supervised in Edison, when we were dealing with people where we didn't have who were not Shomer Mitzvos, we did lab tests on a regular basis to ensure, because the bakeries that we certified were Parv, but we did our own lab tests to ensure that the product was Parv. Sometimes we told the person we're doing the lab test every 2 months, and really we did it every 6 months, so it was enough to create a mirsis. But we did lab tests at least twice a year to ensure that the product was Parv. Rabbi Heineman told me there was a bakery in Baltimore that was run by Shomer Shabbos people, and he tasted the challahs, and it was just too good to be true. It didn't taste like Parv challahs to him, and he did the same thing. He tested he did a lab test on the challah, and it was dairy. So you have to be vigilant. Here's another good story. And this is a story, I learned a terrific lesson from this story. When I first came to the OU, so I was in charge of an ice cream company. And the ice cream company, after a few weeks, they contacted me. They had a product called Cookies and Cream, where it was ice cream with pieces of cookies in the ice cream. They wanted permission to use Oreo, to bring in Oreo cookies into the plant. Oreos at that time were treif. They were made with lard. Today they're kosher and they're under the OU. But at that time they were treif and they were made with lard. So, I said to him, you have kosher cookies that you're using for the kosher product. Why do you need non-kosher cookies? He said, we have a non-kosher product we want to pack with these Oreo cookies. So I said, well, how are we going to know that you don't, if you have both types of cookies in the plant, how are we going to know that you don't put the Oreo cookies into the kosher product? It's what we call a parallel ingredient. So he said, you don't have to worry, Rabbi, because the Oreo cookies are very expensive. They cost more than double what the kosher cookies cost. The kosher cookies were not a famous name brand. And we would never put the Oreo cookies into the kosher product. So why do we have Oreo cookies altogether? Because there's a company that wants us to pack for them a product called Oreos Cookies and Cream. And in order to be able to call it Oreos Cookies and Cream, we have to use real Oreo cookies. For that company, we'll use the Oreos. So he says, you don't have to worry. And I, at that time, I was still somewhat of a novice, so I spoke to some of the chaverim in the OU, and they said, yeah, it's an Anan Sadi. You know, we didn't have a Mashiach to meet there, but there's an Anan Sadi. There's an Umdanar. There's no reason to be Choshish. Why would they take the non-kosher cookies and use it in the kosher product? Okay, Gavaldi. Some time later, I got a call from a lady who said that she bought a box of ice cream that was manufactured by this company, and the ice cream, and as she's eating the ice cream, she sees the cookies are Oreo cookies, because it was an OU product, because the Oreos, it says on the name of the cookie, Oreos, even though it was pieces, she saw it was Oreo cookies. So I called up the company, and I said, I got a call from a consumer. They said they found Oreo cookies in the OU ice cream. What's going on? So they said, it must have been a mistake or something, maybe some cookie, one cookie piece, somehow or another flew into the vat, or, it was a mistake, that's all. Mistakes happen. But, so I could have said, okay, it was a mistake. So, then I'll continue doing my work. I have plenty of work to do. I was busy. But I went down to the plant. I went with Rabbi Yankel Greenblatt, who used to work at the OU at the time. We went into the plant. And we said, they showed us all around. Everything looked gewaldic. We said, do you have any boxes of OU cookies and cream? And they said, well, we keep them in the freezer. I said, okay, could you get us 10 boxes of OU cookies and cream? So they somewhat reluctantly brought us 10 boxes of the OU cookies and cream ice cream. We took them to the laboratory. We turned on the hot water. We tore off the box. We melted the ice cream. And lo and behold, they all had Oreo cookies. And we spent 5 hours trying to figure out what had happened, because nobody wanted to talk to us anymore. But eventually, what we figured out was that this company was manufacturing the cookies and cream ice cream for a distributor, and that they had purchased the raw materials for the distributor. And then the distributor, at some point, canceled the contract, and they were stuck with $15,000 worth of Oreo cookies. And they had a shelf life, I don't remember what it was, but a certain amount of time. And they had no use for it. They couldn't use it, at least legally they couldn't use it. So when it came close to the end of the shelf life, they decided they didn't want to lose $15,000, so they started introducing them into the kosher product. So here is an example of how the Anansari was a terrific Anansari. It made a lot of sense. But the mitzvahs changed, the reality changed, there was pieces of information that we didn't understand the whole parsha of how it was going to operate, and therefore, that's what happened. We have a mashkiach who's very astute. He went into a company, I don't know if it's come up in some of the discussions here. At times we will allow a company to self-kasher the equipment. If the standard cleanup procedure meets the requirements of kashering, so then we will allow a company to self, let's say a company uses, for example, wine vinegar. And then they do a cleanup that constitutes kosherization. Rav Moshe has a tshuva. Rav Moshe says if the company is doing it for their own purposes, so then you could be, if they're doing it for you, so obviously then you need a mashkiach tmidi. But if they're doing it anyway for purposes of cleanliness, so then you could rely on the company. So we often have to determine what is the standard cleanup procedure of the company, and what temperature is it done, because the kashering has to be at a chatchila anyway. We would want the kashering to be at least at 190 degrees. Rybowski said that he heard from Rav Moshe that 190 degrees is considered mala resicha. So chatchila we try for 212, but if that's not possible, we go with 190. The shasa tchak will rely on kabbalah kachboto, but that's only if there's really a very big tzarech. So in any event, so there was this company that was using wine vinegar, and they were doing a cleanup, and the mashkiach was very snoopy, and he read whatever materials he could find, production manuals. He read through them, and he found something that didn't make sense to him. The company had on the reactors or the kettles or whatever pieces of equipment they had, there were heat graphs. They have ways of measuring the heat temperature, and they record it on a graph. So when you walk in at any given time, you could see the history of the heat on the graph. So he saw that in the company manuals, it said that the production temperature can't exceed, let's say, 175 degrees. But then when he looked at the heat graphs, he saw that they were producing at 195 degrees. So something didn't stim. So what he figured out was that they wanted to misrepresent their cleanup procedure, that it was taking place at 190 degrees. Really, it was 20 degrees less, at 170 degrees. So what they did was they changed the calibration. It's like if, let's say, you're on a diet and you're afraid to weigh yourself. You went to a chasen, and you're afraid you'll weigh yourself, and you see you gained a lot of weight. So what you do is, instead of setting the scale to zero, a lot of scales allow you to carry. So if you set it 10 pounds below zero, so when you stand on the scale, you won't have gained weight. So that's what he did with the calibration of the heat graph. He changed the calibration so that it was registering 20 degrees lower. So when we came in and we looked at it, it appeared as if the kashering was taking place at the right temperature. Here's another story about a restaurant. We had a Chinese restaurant, and the mashkiach was very astute. He didn't trust anybody, and he labeled everything, and he had everything, anything was in the refrigerator, he had some on him all over the place. So one day he came to the restaurant 10 minutes early, and he stood across the street in a bank that was opposite the restaurant and had glass windows. He wanted to see what's going on in the before he comes, and he had the keys to the restaurant. So the owners could not get into the restaurant without his opening the doors. So he sees that the owner of the restaurant shows up with two shopping bags in his hand, one in either hand, and there was a stairwell right next to the restaurant. He goes up the stairwell with the two shopping bags, and then he comes down without the two shopping bags. So, something's fishy. So when he opened up the restaurant, he quickly ran out, he ran up the stairwell, and he saw that in those shopping bags were fillet pieces of chicken, in each shopping bag. And obviously what the owner was planning to do, they're very fast in Chinese restaurants,
the mashgiach, he would turn around for a minute, go to the bathroom. They would have had those filleted pieces of chicken in the batter and the oil cooking away in the frying pan before anybody would notice them. So, you know, we immediately terminated the supervision, but that's how vigilant you have to be. So this is and I just want to mention one other thing about vigilance, and that is what often happens is that people who are involved in kashrus, they start out with a lot of years shemayim, and they're very idealistic, and they're full of enthusiasm, and they're going to be very careful. And then what happens is you go to the plant and you check it once and twice, or to the butcher shop or the bakery, wherever it is, and you checked it for 5 years and 10 years. And after a while, either you get burned out or you begin to feel, what's Kenzai? You know, I've been here so many times. I know the places backwards and forwards. They're not doing any shtick, or I know the guy and he's a nice guy and he would never do anything wrong. And you lose that sense of zihirus. And that's when you become a non-qualified mashgiach. When you no longer, when you don't ask yourself the question of how do I know? I once went in Chicago, I spent a week's time with one of our very good mashgiach, with Rabbi Elimelech Friedman. Wherever we went into a plant, he taught me this lesson. You always have to ask, how do I know? Just because they tell you something, how do I know? How can I verify it? A Rav HaMashu or a mashgiach always has to ask himself, how do I know? How do I know that this is the case? And if you begin to lose that, if you become lackadaisical, and you don't have the passion that you started out with, then it's time to retire, because you always have to be vigilant. I want to spend just a few more minutes talking about a more general issue, and that is the Vada Kashrus in a city. If you become Rabbanim in cities, and I've had the OU has made an offer to various communities to allow that we would come and do reviews of kosher operations in different cities. And I've done a series of reviews over the years in different parts of America. So I want to talk a little bit about what's the right way to do hashkacha in a city, in a broader sense. And the point that I want to make is that there's two models that you have out there. One model is that you have in the city, you have three rabbanim or five rabbanim, and each one makes Shabbos for himself. Everyone gives his own hashkachas. And the other model is where you have one Vada HaKashrus. And I could just tell you that having one unified Vada HaKashrus is 1,000 times better than having separate Hesherim. Because what it does is it unifies the community. And and unfortunately, you know, in Klal Yisrael, the some of the most fertile grounds for Machlokes are issues like the height of the Mechitza or the Mikvah or the Eruv. And Kashrus is right there in the center, where you have one Rav is giving Hashir in one place, and the other Rav says, I don't trust that place, and his Baal Batim won't eat in the houses of the people that are eating in that place. And it does is it destroys the community, creates pirud and separation and machlokas. And in contrast, where you have a community where the Rabbanim work together, it's a Kiddush Hashem. The people in the community appreciate the sense of unity. And at the same time, it strengthens the kashrus, because you always need to have more than one person. It's just not healthy to have one person who's overseeing the whole geshaft. And yet, if you have multiple rabbanim, the rabbanim need to work together. One of the most beautiful models of that is in Queens. My chavi here, Rabbi Schoenfeld, is a member of the Vada of Queens, and he was the past president of the Vada of Queens. And the Vada of Queens is, how many rabbanim? Is it 50 rabbanim? It's 50 rabbanim in Queens, and it's amazing. They all, I mean, just showing you that it's possible to have 50 rabbanim from 50 different shuls, and they all work together. They have one Vada Kashrus, they have a very outstanding administrator, they have one standard for the whole community. And we have, Baruch Hashem, our Vada is we don't have 50 rabbanim, we have about 7 or 8 rabbanim in Edison Highland Park. But we all work together, and we all have one standard. But I've been to communities where the communities are fractionated because each rabbi is giving his own hashir, and he doesn't trust the other rabbi. So that's, now the truth is that there are challenges. If you have different rabbanim, so the main reason why, or one of the main, I mean, sometimes the reasons why the rabbanim don't work together is just they don't get along, which is tragic. But other times it's because they have different standards, And so each one says, well, how am I going to work with him? He's a cow. I can't, I'm not going to be able to work with his standards. So what I always suggest is that in such a case, what you need to do is you have to find an outside person who shovel chol nefesh and say, this person is going to be our posik. This person is going to establish the standards for us. Or this kasha say, the truth is you need somebody to pass in shayos, and you need also on a practical level how to implement the hashgachas. Not every shayla is something that a posik could, not everything is in shulchan aruch. I mean, like I mentioned before, the problems in the dairy part of bakery, you're not going to find that in shulchan aruch. If you're experienced and you've been to bakeries, you know the types of problems that you can have in a bakery. For example, they have sheet pans. They cook things on sheet pans. So they're going to have dairy sheet pans and power sheet pans. They have to be able to identify which ones are dairy and which ones are power. The places that I've been to, the identification always gets worn off. The bakeries are not hospital environments. They're not clean. So they paint on with red paint and what's dairy and what's power, and red and blue paint. Paint comes off or it gets covered up with schmutz. But worse than that is that they'll stack the trays. And they're in a rush. So they grab trays, and then when they're finished using them, they stack them one on top of the other. So if you have a dairy tray underneath a power of tray, so what happens is the cream cheese from the cheesecake gets on the bottom of the power of tray, and then they put the power of tray in the oven, and it's greasy. And then after they finish baking with that tray, then they put the challahs right down on the oven hearth, and they're baking power of challahs on an oven that has either bain or bleus of dairy. So that type of idea, a posik is not necessarily going to happen. So you need a combination. You need a posik, and you also need a kashrus agency that has the expertise. And if the rabbanim are not able to agree on the standards, so they have to find somebody from the outside, and that eliminates the tension. You don't have to fight about things. You don't have to have my standards, your standards. This way, you're mekabel that you're going to follow the standards that are suggested by the outside agency, and in that way, it would be possible to create a unified vada kashas. Now, the one pitfall is what I mentioned before, is that oftentimes when you have a vada kashas, so what happens is the rabbanim, they hire a kashas administrator, and then they because they don't have time for the kashas, and then they never walk into the facilities for the rest of their tenure in their position as the rabbanim. That's also no good, because then what happens is there's one professional guy who runs the whole show. It's not a healthy situation, and it's the rabbanim have to stay involved in kashas. They got to be involved. They got to be hands on. They got to go to the places that they supervise. They got to watch what's going on. They're the ones that have to create the standards. The professional needs to work under the direction, but they have to create the standards. Rabbi Grossman is here. You have time for questions? Yeah.
First one is, but your shiach always have any key, and you order not have any keys? That's the first question. But how do you supervise in a situation like a restaurant where only the mashgiach should have the keys and not the owner ever? How do you control that? How do you control the owner not doing pulling your shtick you talked about? The second question is, an employee of a restaurant also being asked to be the mashgiach by an outside agency.
So the first question was, how do you control the key? I'm not sure I understand the question. You control the keys by the mashgiach makes the lock. You can't have the owner give you his set of keys, because he can give you one set and have another set. So the mashgiach has to buy a lock, and he has to be the only one that has the key. Now they sometimes need to have emergency access to the restaurant. That's why they'll typically resist that. So what you do is you take a spare set of keys and you put it in an envelope, and you seal the envelope with a chasima, and you put it in a drawer someplace, so that if there's ever an emergency, if there's a fire or something, he has to get in, he has the key, and you just tell him that he has to notify you if he ever accesses that key. But, I mean, the problem with the Chinese restaurant that I was talking about before was not that the owner had the key. The owner had no key. But there was a stairwell right adjacent to the restaurant, so he would have run in with the product. As far as the second question, import.
Go back to the pizza shop issue where he brought in crepe cheese. That was not, is that a question whether the mashgiach had the keys or not?
The Mashiach did not have the keys. We, at that time, we were relying, we didn't have a Mashiach Tamidi, and we didn't, I mean, you can't lock up a restaurant unless you have a Mashiach Tamidi. If we had locked it up, we couldn't come in at night, but we didn't have a Mashiach Tamidi. You can't lock it up unless you have a Mashiach Tamidi. I wouldn't do the Hashkacha that way anymore, but that, at that time, we didn't have the keys. As far as your other question, the, an employee being a Mashiach, the ideal would be to have a person who's designated to be the mashgiach and does nothing else in the restaurant. Unfortunately, the reality is that's very expensive, and almost no restaurant is able to afford to have a salaried person. You pay him whatever the salary is for mashgiach to just sit there and watch the walls. So typically what happens is that the mashgiach is what we call working mashgiach, where he works in the restaurant. At the same time, he serves as the mashgiach. The downside is that psychologically, if he's doing work in the restaurant, it's hard for him to maintain the presence that the mashgiach has to feel that he's in charge, and he doesn't take orders from the owner. The owner takes orders from him. But if he has a dual responsibility, so when it comes to his function as an employee, so the owner is the boss. When it comes to kashrus, he's representing the kashrus agency. But that the gemara, it's a chesaron, but it's a reality that's very difficult to do away. There's just no real solution for that because of financial realities. The bigger question is, what about the owner himself? Could the owner himself be the mashgiach in his facility? If the owner is shomer mitzvahs, could the owner serve as the mashgiach? Now, halachically, an owner could be, an owner has namanis, and there's no concept of negias when it comes to eidachanam and visurim. And so, technically, you have a person in shomer mitzvahs, he could serve as the mashgiach. He could have a yotzei v'nichnas, but he could serve as the mashgiach. The Arvad does not allow that type of setup, and the reason why we don't allow it is because most of the owners in the stores in our community are members of the community, daven in our shuls. Some of them I would trust to be in charge of the store, and some of them I wouldn't trust. I can't tell Chaim Yankel, you could be the mashgiach in your store, and then when Shimon comes to me, I say, I don't trust you, you can't be. He said, what about Chaim Yankel? Well, he's different than you. I can't do that. So therefore, we made a low plug that we're just not having owners be self-supervising the stores. There are many vadim that do allow the owners to serve as the mashgiachim. This is the way we operate in Edison. The Rabbanim have to use their discretion to decide what's the best way to set it up. Let's see if somebody else has a question. It would be, the question is, who should pay the mashgiach? If he's an employee, he's going to be paid by the store. Again, the ideal would be to have the mashgiach paid by the vad. That would, psychologically, is much better, and it's healthier, and you have more control. But the reality is that it rarely happens. One of the main reasons is because of insurance, that the vad doesn't have, can't provide the types of insurance, health insurance, and also FICA and things like that, and disability. So therefore, most of the time, the mashgiach is paid by the store. It's not a chatchila, but it's an unfortunate reality. If there's a way to do it that the mashgiach is paid by the vad, that's obviously far superior. No, I'm not saying it's preferable not to. There's always, look, the ideal would be, let's say in a regular food company, the OU doesn't have mashgiach tamidi in a regular food company. The ideal would, if we could have a mashgiach tamidi, then all the stories that I'm telling you probably wouldn't have happened. The ideal would be to have mashgiach tamidi. It's not possible. The company's not going to pay for it. It's not shach. Al pi din, it's the system that we have of yotzei v'nichnas is acceptable. And that's what we rely on. The same thing is true in a restaurant. I mean, if you have a responsible Mashiach, if he's a Ben Torah and he's a Yari Shemayim and he's responsible, so Al Pi Din, you're allowed to rely on him. Is it better? Is there a better way to do it? There is a better way to do it, but I'm not saying Chas V'Shalom that you shouldn't be. If you're not going to rely on those Mashkichim, you're going to eliminate most of the restaurants in the world. And I'm not making such a dramatic statement. If a person wants to personally have chumras, you know, there's ein shir to chumras. I have a fellow in my shul who's not a strong ben tari. He's a nice, plain, simple baal bas. He's working as a mashgiach in a certain food company. He came to me and he said to me that I think that you should only eat food that you make in your own house. You shouldn't buy anything from. And I was like stunned that here's a fellow who's not even I could understand a person who's a Rosh Hashiva might say that. He came to that Hakar himself. There's so many problems. But look, Al Pi Din, the same thing I said before about doing lab tests. I mean, you could test every single ingredient in the place, and that, you know, obviously, if you tested everything, so then they. But it's not shaykh to do it, and it's not Al Pi Din, you're not required to do it, and there are gedarim and halacha. The kashrus agency has to try to exceed the gedarim of halacha, because otherwise they're not going to find the problems. And it's their job to try to uncover, if there are problems, they have to try to uncover it. But I'm not saying that if you follow the principles of halacha, of mirsus and umda and anansadi and all, I mean, Ramesha relies on anansadi for many things. So, you know, those are, I'm not saying that you shouldn't rely on those types of hashkachas. Yes?
Relying on video cameras or types of cameras.
A video camera, the question is, can you rely on a video camera? A video camera is just as good as seeing it, but it means that you have to have somebody has to either have the zitz place to sit and look at the video camera, or you know, it's possible to have it a fast forward system that you could review a long tape in very quickly. But you have to just make sure that the video camera is set up in a way that you can't get in under the radar, you know, sneak in below the range of the video camera.
There one last question. Yeah.
Was reference if one made to the fact that the Mashgichim can get burnt out and they can become familiar? Is there a system that allows you to rotate the Mashgichim so that they don't become too familiar and too lax? The guard down?
The honest answer to that question, the question is there a system in the OU of rotating the Mashgichim to different plants so that that way they would not get burned out? The honest answer is no, we don't have such a system. It's something that maybe we should consider. I mean, one of the things that we try to do that they shouldn't get burned out is that first we have conferences for the Mashgichim, we bring them into New York so that we should meet with them. They should feel that there's somebody that cares. We try to visit the plants. The people in the office go out to the field to visit the plants with them. That gives them a chizuk. We have a review program in place where we have a whole department set up just to do reviews, and we have a group of outstanding mashgichim. We call them super mashgichim. They go in and they do review, and you know, we hope that that way we keep them you know, alert and on their toes.
Go ahead, Rabbi Lubin. Thank you.